Now we're going to take a walk on the other side, a traveler's guide to the afterlife. Mark Mirabello joins me, and we'll be back with Dr. Mark in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Mark Mirabello is an author and professor of history at Shawnee State University. His expertise is the outlaw history on the frontiers and margins of human civilization. He's got a PhD from the University of Glasgow in Scotland and an MA from the University of Virginia as well. And welcome to Coast as we talk about a traveler's guide to the afterlife. Mark, good to have you and welcome and Merry Christmas and hope all is well.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you for having me on your program. It's quite an honor.
I'm looking forward to this. Now, tell me, though, how did a professor of history get involved with dealing with the afterlife?
I've always been a historian of thought and what people believe. In fact, when I was a child, I really thought I'd be a professor since second grade. I remember thinking, well, archaeology or history, but I'm not really interested in what people build and looking at ruins, but more or less what people think and believe. And this is the ultimate question, where we go. We spend a relatively brief time here, and then time apparently it can be vast. So this is the ultimate question.
Do you have any doubts that we indeed do go somewhere after we leave this existence?
Curiously enough, not really. I don't really doubt. In fact, I think it's really important to be focused and believe. One of the points I discuss in the book is that it's the notion that the universe is basically generated by thought. And it's very important that we focus our thoughts in the right way, and we will encounter what we believe. So the Christian will encounter his Jesus in the next world. The Muslim will see the 72 virgins. The hunter on the Great Plains will have the wild bison and the wild cherry juice. So I think it's very important to study all the possible paths. And the Buddha talked about 84,000 different paths to enlightenment. And by the way, I think one of the problems with the West is we're too simplistic about the afterlife. We think that it has to be connected to a god, it has to be connected to an immortal soul, it has to be connected to basically ethics. And one of the things ideas I explore in the book is it's far more complex. And virtually every behavior pattern, every belief system can lead us to a more interesting place.
Yesterday, I had a guest on, Mark. We were talking about space and Mars, and I brought up the original seven Mercury astronauts from this country, and they're all dead now, John Glenn being the latest who died last week. And then I started thinking to myself about musical artists like Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley and all these greats. They're all dead, too. And it hits me that, of course, all of us physically we're going to die one day. It's going to happen. I mean, it's going to happen to you. It's going to happen to me. It's going to happen, sadly, to everybody we love. There's no stopping that, is there?
Well, oddly enough, and again, 99.9999 and so forth percent of us will die. But I do make a few references to, for example, there are legends of those who don't die. And since approximately 40 billion people or more have existed on the Earth that we think we know of, there have been these legends, for example, the three Nephites in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There's the story that the Apostle John still lives, because there's a reference in the very end of the Gospel of John. Peter is asking John, what happens to this man? And Jesus says, he will tarry till I come again. So the Middle Ages thought that he was still around, as frankly do the Mormons. And then we have the immortals and Chinese legend. But again, realistically, we're all going to die. I've been kind of intrigued by what's called eternalism, though, and the notion of block time, that essentially what happens, well, essentially the passage of time really doesn't occur. McTaggart proposed this in the early 20th century at Oxford, but it's actually an Eastern idea, and that all time exists always. So, for example, right now, Frank Sinatra is 21 years old somewhere, singing, and undiscovered probably. And somewhere you are a two-year-old child playing on the floor. Somewhere you're an elderly person.
Yeah.
And it's just an interesting concept. That so essentially, if this is true, when we die, we immediately start over again and return to the womb.
You have asked the question, could we be dead now? What do you mean by that?
Well, actually, that's a notion that's found in various traditions. Euripides, the Greek writer, talks about it. The Greeks, for example, noticed that, strangely enough, death, especially violent death, seems to be pleasurable. They find dead soldiers, not to get graphic on you, on the battlefield in the state, what appears to be sexual arousal. Executed men are in the same state. And our births, in contrast, are very traumatic. We tend to focus on the suffering of the mothers for obvious reasons, but in fact, probably, unless we die in some really colorful fashion, you and I, the most horrible experience we'll ever have will be birth, because we're in a warm, dark place, protected, mm-hmm. and then we're thrust into a Bang. Place of light and sound and noise. So the Greeks noticed this, and they essentially thought we couldn't be certain. This could be, in fact, when we were born here, it was our death into an other world. And then when we die here, we're actually being born. And by the way, Eurasian cultures in Siberia and so forth, there's always this notion that the other side is a mirror world. So it's everything's reversed. The Siberians talked about that when it's winter here, it's summer over there. When there's plague here, there's healthy times there. So we, in fact, and by the way, I again talk about this in the book, we really can't be certain what this universe is that we're in right now. Science tries to tell
us. It's a matrix.
Yes, yes, in a sense. Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, Elon Musk, of course, thinks that we're in a digital world, that we really don't exist, that we're just all digital. What do you think of that?
That's very possible. I tend to go, since I'm more traditional, there's the, again, Eastern notion that we're all in the dream of a god or an entity of some sort, that he's simply dreaming or daydreaming. I remind you, of course, pleasure and pain seems real in dreams when we're there.
Of course.
And there's also the notion that when we awake in the morning, we're simply awakening to another dream. So that when we're in our day-to-day activities, that's one dream, and then we go to sleep at night, that's another. The only difference is we tend to forget what happens in our nightly dreams, but we tend to remember what goes on day-to-day, and that's why we think that's more real than the night dream. Although there's various Amazon cultures that think that the dream state is actually more real than the waking state.
Taking out the religious implications, we really can't explain why we're here, can we?
You know, that's an interesting question, because humans tend to always think that the universe, in every culture, even primitive cultures, there's a rationality to it, there's a purpose to it, and it may simply be that we're here for no apparent reason whatsoever. Cicero talks about that we could be like mice living in a mansion that was designed for others. We're moving around in the walls and stealing food, and we think we're important, but in fact we're not. So we could just be fringe entities in a much larger universe.
Now, when we talk about existence, how did we get here? How did we form? I mean, I don't subscribe to the theory that, you know, we evolved from other creatures and little organisms. There's something bigger here, Mark.
Well, I'm going to plagiarize. There's an evangelical preacher that makes this. He means it even as a joke, and I'm going to use it the same way. He says if you take hydrogen, which, of course, is the simplest element, and you wait a long, 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 long time, it eventually turns into humans. And that's essentially what science is teaching us right now. There's the Big Bang Theory, and then eventually the pieces from the blast cool and form stars, and then supernovas form the heavier elements. And eventually planets form, and then on the planets, various microscopic organisms form, and these eventually evolve through natural selection in the humans. So essentially, science is teaching us that hydrogen on its own over a long, long time produces humans. By the way, I think even the question of origins is inappropriate. It shows the scientists in the West have the Judaic-Christian background, because there's a linear time in Judaism and Christianity where there's a start and a finish. Jainism in India, for example, says we have always been here. The universe has always existed. Our souls, jiva, they've always existed. We were never created and will never be destroyed. And we've existed for trillions and trillions and trillions of years. And by the way, the Jains say, for example, both everyone listening to your program this evening, tonight, Everyone has been a god, everyone's been a king, everyone's been a thief, everyone's been a rapist, everyone's been a rape victim, because we've lived so many lives. And almost nobody escapes from this. And of course, Jainism teaches some techniques to be one of the few that escapes from the endless rebirth. And they're born above everything else and become trans gods, in a sense. But the idea, and I agree with you, I've never really bought into evolutionary theory. And by the way, Wallace, who's the co-founder of the theory, he actually said, and that's why they ignore him in the history of science books by and large, there's two points he said where evolution doesn't work. That's at the origin of life and also at the origin of humans. He thought that some kind of intervention was necessary.
Huh. Now, you have talked about, and you write in the book, of course, A Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife, that the question of science, and can science prove the existence of the afterlife? I'm not sure it can. What do you think?
Well, it's at various times, especially in the 19th century, tried. There was a person named McDougall, and he was very interested in the question. Now, this almost sounds inappropriate today. It sounds like something in a Nazi concentration camp, but he was carefully weighing dying people. It was Duncan McDougall, late 19th, early 20th century. He carefully weighed six dying people under control conditions, and curiously enough, found that the soul weighed about 21 grams, he thought. Now, at that time, he was able to publish in a legitimate medical journal. Today, if someone were to do that, they'd be mocked. So I think the problem is, today, science won't even try to prove this. At various times, like I know you've had Dr. Moody on probably your program in the past,
mm-hmm,
Life After Life,
mm-hmm.
And he was a rare example of someone, you know, who was a trained MD, trained PhD, who noticed that people were having what appeared to be, when they were clinically dead, having similar experiences. So every once in a while, you'll have someone who tries to use the techniques of science, observation in this case, in Dr. Moody's case, but mostly they'll just ignore it. And there's a really curious psychologist named, he's regrettably passed away, named Lorber from the, I'm trying to remember, I think he was from the University of Sheffield. And he noticed there was, because again, our current culture tradition teaches that the mind is just generated by the brain. In fact, a 19th century physician argued it was similar to the way the bladder generates urine, strangely enough. And Lorber found, at first initially, it was a math student at the University of Sheffield who had virtually no brain. He had only about 1 millimeter of brain tissue over fluid in his head, and he had an IQ of 126.
Wow.
And
unheard of.
And before Lorber's death, he actually found nearly 100 similar people. And this research is just ignored. Of course, I'm sure you're familiar with the Fortean phenomenon.
If
it's too unusual, they're not going to pay attention to it. And William James, in the late 19th century psychologist, he suggested that all the brain really does is has a transmissive function, similar to what the high technology of his time was, the Great Atlantic Cable. You could send a telegram from New York to London, which was wonder at the time, instantaneously. And he said all the brain is really doing is the mind helps the mind network with this physical world. And, of course, we notice that when the brain is damaged, the communication is interrupted. When the brain is destroyed, it stops. But the same thing with the radio. If you brought a primitive radio to a primitive group of people, and they'd be hearing your voice on coast to coast, and then if we altered the radio or destroyed it, it would stop. And they would insist that that voice, your voice, is coming right from the box and not from elsewhere.
Right. We're with Mark Mirabello. We're talking about his work, of course, A Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife. Mark, do you believe that there's indeed a soul? And if there is, what's its function and purpose?
Well, curiously enough, I keep criticizing the West, but I think we've simplified the soul too much. In most earlier cultures, indeed even in early Christianity, there's multiple souls. And I think this causes all this confusion. Originally, in Christianity, the soul is not the same as the spirit. The spirit is what the Greeks called the body soul. It gives you life. That's why you can have your spirit still in your body, but your mind is gone, so you're in a coma. And but for some reason, we've run these two concepts together. And we've confused them in a sense. But I think the ancients are probably more on the money when they talked about several different souls. The Egyptians had several. And it's simply, as you say, the mind or personality. By the way, the Greeks, interestingly enough, when they called it the psyche, the important one, that's the dream soul. And what exists, according to the Greeks, is not, for example, the George Nori I'm talking to right now will not exist after death. The George Nori that was dreaming last night will exist, because only the dream soul exists. And the Greeks noticed the parallel between the dream state and death. In fact, that's almost a universal concept, that if you want to know what death is like, you were there last night. We find that all across the globe. So the notion of this indestructible mortal soul, which we do find in Hinduism and Christianity and so forth and Islam, it's not a universal idea. Normally there's multiple souls, and you have to take various steps to keep that one soul alive in many cultures. The Egyptians are especially focused on that point. They thought that the soul itself was not immortal. It could be killed. And that's why they invested the deceased with all kinds of magical tools and weapons so he could defend himself in the next world. In fact, the Egyptians thought the afterlife was a continuous journey, and it paralleled the path of the sun. Every morning, the sun is born from the womb of his mother, and then travels across the sky in a boat across the celestial Nile, and then he dies in the arms of his mother, Nut, at night. But then he has to travel this dangerous path through the underworld, which is at the dark side. The sun was on the other side. And the Egyptians tried to give people the ability to travel with the sun god. And curiously enough, if successful, they would return in the morning to this world. So the Egyptian dead were here with us. In fact, the Egyptians are really close to the deceased. I think that's an interesting notion. We also find that in ancient Australia, the Aboriginal people, the dead never leave. They go to the west where the sun sets, but they're still here.
Your book kind of reminds me of the classic Tibetan Book of the Dead.
That is a thank you for the comparison. It's almost like the movie Twins, if you remember that.
Right.
I'm Danny DeVito.
And I'm Arnold.
it does indeed. The Tibetan Book of the Dead is a fascinating work. And incidentally, I think it's intriguing because Westerners, using the research of near-death experience, we all think, in a sense, because we experience bright lights and so forth, that we're in heaven. But the Tibetan Book of the Dead makes clear that the Bardo state, which can last up to 49 days, we begin with a kind of glorious light and beautiful, loud sounds. But then there's a descent that occurs. If you're not properly enlightened, you spend a period of time in which it's very beautiful, but then you see these beautiful entities, which you'll interpret as godlike or angelic-like beings. But then if you're not wise enough or prepared enough, you continue to descend, and you experience these hellish beings that are horrifying. And you'll probably think you're in hell.
Yes.
Of course, the Tibetan Book of the Dead says, do not be attracted to the beautiful beings. They're
don't
only
don't stop. You. Don't let them basically attach themselves to you.
Exactly. And then it gives techniques to basically game the system. The Tibetan Book of the Dead is from Diamond Vehicle Buddhism in Tibet, which is the short path. And it tells you what to look for and what to do in between lives. And curiously enough, they thought that there were certain people that had strong wills and minds could maintain their consciousness through this entire process.
Mark, when we come back, I want to talk with you about what you believe the afterlife to be. We'll be back. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Mark Mirabella with us as we talk about A Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife. So when we take that travel, Mark, where are we headed? What's on that other side?
Well, frankly, there's so many interesting ideas. I really couldn't pick a favorite, although one that does appeal to me was put forward in the 19th century by a person named Schofield that basically said that the dead are in the fourth dimension. It was only in the 19th century that mathematicians came up with the notion that physical things could have more than, or I should say, things could exist at more than three dimensions. And Schofield suggested that God and the dead are actually in the fourth dimension, which explains why we could sometimes see them hear and feel their contact. There's a famous passage in the book of Daniel where a hand writes on the wall, and he explains that could be a fourth dimensional entity, a god, if you will. There's also, I think for most of your listeners, they probably would be attracted to the teachings of Emanuel Swedenborg, who was the 18th century seer who claimed to have all, he was a scientist and an aristocrat.
He was amazing.
Yes, and he claimed to have really detailed notions, a really beautiful concept of what the other side was like. He was traditional enough to keep heaven and hell, but basically said that we freely choose these places. Aleister Crowley used to joke, the occultist, that he'd be miserable in heaven. He wanted wild women and song and drugs and alcohol. And then, according to Swedenborg, that's where he went. Swedenborg said, we're attracted by our ruling love. Some people like peace and humility and love, and they're drawn to the beautiful people on the next side. Others want crime, violence, rape, killing, theft, and all the rest. And Swedenborg said, just as frogs are drawn to swamps, a frog would be miserable in a beautiful pasture with flowers. The evil people cluster in hellish regions where they prey upon one another and are actually quite happy doing that. There was a classic Twilight Zone episode similar to that where a bank robber is killed at the start of the episode, and he thinks he's in heaven, but he gets really bored really fast. And he tells this person that's been guiding him around, he thinks is an angel, that he wants to go to the other place. And, of course, the entity says, this is the other place. That's why he's so bored. I've also, by the way, this is not really a death trek, but I've always been attracted to the eternal recurrence concept, which was found in ancient Babylon. Friedrich Nietzsche, the 19th century philosopher, was a big supporter that essentially our immortality is our same life over and over again. But in this case, Nietzsche said there's finite possibilities and infinite time. And just as if you were playing a dice game, or let's say chess, there's only so many different games you can play. And then it starts to repeat exactly. I remember before my father passed away, he used to be really intrigued by that concept. Because both my father and myself, we've enjoyed life. So I would be intrigued by the notion I could come back and, in fact, once again, be on your show in the same way. So there are just so many possibilities, and in fact, that's one of the things I tried to explore in the book, and there are different paths. I don't really think there's just one place to go and one way to do it. I think there's any number of places.
Well, in the process of death, I kind of want you to speculate a little bit here, Mark, and take us through the moment of death when someone physically dies. What happens after that, then?
Well, I think the best descriptions we referred to earlier would be the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And they say that you experience the clear light of the void. It's a just an incredibly bright light, more than 1,000 suns, and it makes a sound greater than 1,000 thunderbolts. Now, if you can merge with the clear light of the void, that means you're enlightened and you escape from the endless cycle of rebirth. But most people will shrink back. And then there's a secondary light from which we also shrink back. And then, and again, I think this is where the West goes off the rails a bit. People will describe the initial stages. In fact, I remember talking about this in one of my university classes, and I looked out, and there was a woman who was a non-traditional student, looked rather unhappy, and I inquired, and she said that she had had a horrible, she was around 45 when she was in the class, she had had a horrible automobile accident while intoxicated on alcohol as well as drugs, and had been actually clinically dead, and thought she had gone to heaven, and because she saw these beautiful lights and beautiful beings, and she could never figure it out because she was doing bad things just before the accident, and had actually killed somebody in the accident. But of course, she was disappointed when I was describing it's only the initial stage. And what the East emphasizes is you must remain calm throughout the entire process. You must have no fear and no attachment. And oddly enough, we often will continue attachment to loved ones. and we'll think about lost loves or parents, perhaps children. But they say that's not a good thing to do. The Buddha talks about the three poisons of love, hate, and delusion. And it's funny, they always often translate love as lust here, because we think love is just good. If you love, it must be good. But according to the Buddhist traditions, that's attachment. And even attachment to something good is bad over there, because you must move on. And what's really curious, too, is how this is a universal concept, except for the Egyptians, of course, that work completely alone. And it's all up to us. Jainism is the most extreme, where even a god can't help you. And everybody is alone and must make the proper decisions and do the proper things to achieve a better place. So death will be a long process, and as long as the person remains calm and focused, they'll take them up. And incidentally, the Tibetan Buddhists say that what we do in our hospitals over here, a huge percentage of Americans die drugged up, essentially, in a stupor, because we've developed a culture that is too sensitive to pain, and we think we must suppress pain at all costs. But sadly, the Tibetans say we're increasing the chance that that person will be reborn as an animal in their next life. Now, that's not the end of the game. It just requires perhaps another 8 million lives to get back to the human state. But because the person is confused and drugged up, he cannot possibly, they say, or it's very difficult for him to go up. So it's important to be alert and awake and focused during the dying moments, according to the traditions. And I think that's perhaps true.
Remember the incredible movie based on the book, What Dreams May Come, with the late Robin Williams, how ironic. Just a very interesting take on heaven and hell and what is going on like that. That has some reality to it, Mark.
I think so. Oddly enough, I never saw that film.
Oh, you have got to see this movie.
Yes, I definitely have. By the way, when he sadly committed suicide with hanging, I mentioned there's all kinds of possible. Now, again, I don't recommend anyone do this that's listening.
Yes,
there's actually the rope goddess in the Mayan tradition has a paradise for people who do that. It again shows that there's just so many different possibilities. Even great sinners, if you will, can find places. There's actually places for headhunters, too, from Borneo.
Yet the Catholic Church has always taught us if you do that, you go straight to hell.
That's true. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I don't think most people are aware, and this is not a critical comment, but the idea that hell is eternal is actually an invention of, we don't see it before Christianity comes up with it. There's no culture that taught that or no tradition that taught it until Christianity. And now, I want to make it clear, this is not a universal idea. We found that the very early Christian movements, because again, there were all kinds of disagreements, and you have various universalist movements that say that everybody goes to paradise, that God eventually loves everybody. Origen, the early church father, even suggested that even Satan himself will eventually be forgiven. And again, these ideas pop up in, not to be advertising Mormonism again, but they have the concept that hell is not really eternal because you can escape from hell. If you convert and accept the faith, you can be released from hell, even from the other side. I think, though, and incidentally, in Buddhism, they have a 576 million year hell, but you eventually escape. And in Jainism, they again talk about there's 24 great pathfinders who lead people into truth. And right now, the next one who will come to us is presently in hell, a hellish realm, paying for a great crime, which oddly enough involves suicide, among other things. But he will be purified and eventually be a great leader and teacher of the human race. And I think the notion that, again, this is my personal opinion now, crimes you may commit in a finite lifetime, you would be punished forever, is a bit extreme. And I think the East perhaps has it a bit more on the money, where they say that if you do something really wonderful, oh, by the way, I should mention, not that I hope we're not going on too long in these points, but karma is really misunderstood in the West because, again, we're influenced by Christian thought. And most people think that in the Eastern traditions, they will your good deeds and your bad deeds are weighed, and whatever prevails leads you up or down. That's not how it's done. In fact, each completed action produces another life. So, for example, while you're living, you're producing thousands of new lives. When you help an elderly lady across the street, you're actually producing a future, or I should say, another positive life. When a person does something mean to another, or hurts them or causes pain, this produces a low birth. And we're accumulating thousands of these. The Buddha has a great line where he talks about one of his disciples. He points to a mountain in the Himalayas, and he says, if all your skeletons from all your previous lives were gathered in one location, it'd be taller than this mountain. And Westerners are always thinking, I wanted to find out if I was Henry VIII in a previous life, although since he executed perhaps 72,000 people, that's not a good one. But we tend to simplify things too much. And by the way, an evil person, what they're doing when they die can produce a positive next life, which is interesting. So a great criminal, if he does something really generous, can actually come back as a god in his next life.
Well, that's probably true. What do you think of ghosts, Mark?
Well, fascinating. I have a whole couple sections on them in the work. And again, I think we're a bit simplistic in the West. Now, the really intriguing ones are the wraiths. They tend to occur within 24 hours of death. And they tend to convey a meaningful communication. They may be telling the persons on Earth that they love us. They may be giving a location of a will, or they may be identifying a criminal that murdered them. So they're by far the most interesting. But then people are puzzled by the standard ghosts. For example, 19th century scientists were researching this. Myers was among the early researchers. And the regular hauntings, they seem to do the same thing over and over again. And they don't seem to be really intelligent. And that led most 19th century scientists to conclude that we're just witnessing something that's perhaps telepathic in nature. Myers himself said that we're witnessing the dreams of the dead. Hence, they were basically repetitious and perhaps confused. But I think, again, if you go to ancient Egypt, they had the sense of the ka. And what a sense of this was is one of the souls stayed behind around the body. And it's interesting that virtually always ghosts are found around bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to get rid of the haunting, you dig it up and you find the body and destroy it. Incidentally, the Fox sisters that started the modern spiritualist movement in the 1840s, there was eventually, in the early 20th century, they found a skeleton inside the house they were in, which is interesting because it could explain, these were little girls that claimed they were being communicated with someone who had been murdered in the house. Now, today, modern textbooks will always describe that one of the Fox sisters, as an adult, went on stage in Chicago, I think it was, and said that it was all trickery. But they don't tell you that she was paid. She was virtually homeless by then, and she was paid to say that.
To say that, yeah.
So, but ghosts are, it's kind of curious that people fear them.
Well, some of them aren't too benevolent.
Well, that's true, but I mean, most of them, if it's a really conscious entity, for example, in Judaism, the concept that some people don't realize they're dead, and that's why they're hanging around your house, and they're still living in the same house, and they may be angry with you living there. And again, in the Jewish Kabbalah lore and Talmud and so forth, these are conscious entities there, but they're in a sense unhappy entities. So they're more miserable than we are. And by the way, while I'm on it, kind of a common mistake, people will use Ouija boards to try to...
I tell people, stay away from those things.
But they'll try to determine the future. And if the ghosts are real, and again, I steal the Greek idea, they're only going to know what they had in their minds the day they died. So if you communicate with a ghost who died in 1952, he's going to still think it's 1952. And he's not going to know anything of the future, even the present.
Do they want to harm us?
It's curious. If you go to the Aboriginal people in Australia, they say that you must never travel alone because they can be mischievous, even loving entities when they're dead, take on a malicious aspect. We find that in many cultures, that for some reason, even a loved one, when they become a ghost, can be, shall we say, mischievous. But typically, they really can't inflict harm, although there are exceptions. For example, the famous Flying Dutchman ship, which had a ghostly crew, and if anyone saw it, they would die a horrible death soon after. And the legend was the captain came ashore every 100 years looking for a woman. This apparently was before Match.com.
So, or ParanormalDate.com.
Yes, exactly, true.
There you go.
Incidentally, if anyone is to your listeners, the best protection against a ghost is to cross running water. That's why ghosts often gather along rivers and streams, because the legend is they can't cross. And also, the best one is you throw a fistful of grave earth into the ghost's face, and he will become docile and has to obey everything you tell him to do. So there are various protections. Another old trick is to draw a circle around yourself. They seem to have difficulty penetrating circles.
I didn't know that.
Yes, that you see the circles universal also in magical operations. When people are summoning entities and ritual magic, the real function of the circle is to protect them from the being that appears. Because typically it's a dangerous entity. This is often a demonic form, and he'll attack you when he first appears. So often the ritual magician will hurl a live mouse at him and try to force him into a triangle. By the way, that's why, I'm not sure if they've corrupted it, but the original Ouija boards have triangles on the planchette, because when the spirit must speak the truth when he's in the triangle, and they typically lie to us. That's why we shouldn't really pay attention to them.
Why do they lie?
That's unclear. Some have suggested that they're simply bored and they want to keep our attention.
Huh.
So they will make things up. They'll claim to be somebody famous. And by the way, there's that famous, reminds me of, it's a typical notion that you must never believe anything they say.
Hold on, Mark. We're going to come back at the top of the hour. We'll finish that up and take phone calls as we talk about A Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife.